Hello and welcome to The Unreleased, the design research podcast. This podcast exists to help map, broadcast and promote design research worldwide. The Unreleased podcast is brought to you by IAD, Universidade Europeia and UNIT.com. The interview was recorded at IAD as part of the PhD in design program. To know more, visit unrelease.unitcom-yad.pt. That's unrelease.unitcom-yad.pt. In this episode, Professor Ricardo Lusson talks with Bruce Brown, Pro Vice Chancellor for Research at the University of Brighton and a Professor of Design. Brown is an editor of Design Issues Research Journal, and he is a design researcher interested in the social and cultural effects of visual memory. During this conversation, Brown shares his thoughts about meaning in design, design as a human capacity, ethics, and design as a political process.
And if you only see, you know, health and welfare and all the other things as part of what design does, which is good, and I would never undermine any of that, what you leave open is this other kind of underbelly, where now in the digital world, people are using these processes invisibly, you know, to manage, you know, very complex societies when we're all struggling to find forms of democracy. So I think there's a big issue for design, for me, and it's about accepting the political dimensions of design in a social context.
Here are Ricardo and Bruce.
First of all, welcome. Welcome to IAD, Professor Bruce Brown. Historically speaking, do you believe industrial revolution somehow froze design and society in terms of production and object usage?
That is a complicated question. First of all, I don't think there is still any universally accepted definition of design. I think people use it in different contexts, in different ways, but there's nothing professionally we could subscribe to and say this is what we consider to be design. It also depends whether you think design is a profession or a human capacity. I didn't believe it's both things, and I think people have the human capacity to change the world. And I think that's why we are different from all other living things. We can change the physical world around us to make other things. And we do that through design. And that's just the capacity we have. I think design as a profession did emerge with the Industrial Revolution. And it was in response to a whole set of reformation issues about wealth and prosperity and the rise of the merchant class. And it was about an acceptance that ownership of products was a good thing for human beings. Mm-hmm. And part of the Scottish Reformation Enlightenment was part of that. So design began to be the process of, first of all, how do you develop the tools to make the things? So it was a question of tool making. And once you've got the tools, how do you then make the things? And once you've made the things, how do you distribute them? And how do you make people want to buy them? So there was a chain of actions. And I think in the Industrial Revolution, the descriptors of design we now use emerged. So although there's no definition of design, I think we usually refer to it as product design, industrial design, graphic design, textile design. And these are kind of material descriptors of the objects that are produced. So that period in the Industrial Revolution, up until about 1980, was all about the development of artifactual things. I think mobile phones and laptop computers in 1980 changed that. And design then moved to deal with things that are about intangibles, to deal with systems and processes, not objects. So that long explanation in answer to your question is, no, I don't think the Industrial Revolution froze design, but it helped it to emerge in a particular form. And I think it's a human capacity, not just a profession.
Okay, well, picking up on that, I have here many other questions, but there's something here about the design's place in digital age. Because you're talking about the design becoming this more intangible thing, and not so product or artifact oriented. Sure. And I have a question here about how does design profession evolution allow designers to work in several fields not previously explored? In your opinion, can this new diversificate role turn the designer into a non-focused professional?
Right. Just to clarify the way you asked that question, I don't think that the shift from the design of artifacts mm-hmm. to more intangible things like processes was a change from one thing to another. Hmm. I think they all exist.
Okay.
So we still design objects. What we also have is a set of systems, invisible systems and processes around the objects now, mm-hmm. and we design images. So one thing doesn't replace another. All of these things continue to exist.
No, of course, because when you placed that first building tools, then building the objects, so this is just another add-on to that evolution.
Yeah, yeah. So...
Because we still make tools, we still make artifacts,
But I would say one of the big questions is, if you lived in Victorian times or early industrial, you were preoccupied with making the tools you needed mm-hmm. to build the things you wanted. I would say now, actually, we have so many digital tools at our disposal, we can make almost anything we want. The big question is, what do we want to make and why do we want to make it?
Yes.
And that's the issue for design. It's not what we make. It's why we make it and what purpose it serves. So in answer to the question you asked me earlier, I do think designers have moved out of particular artifactual bases. Mm-hmm. Not all, but many designers, to operate across disciplines. And this is why there isn't a definition of design, a universally accepted one, because actually design is not a subject to many people.
Yes.
It's a process by which you bring together the specialized bodies of knowledge in other disciplines. So designers are often seen as the glue, the invisible glue that brings things together to create new solutions. I think the difficulty for me in that, though, that you will hear many eminent designers saying is, well, following the Herbert Simon quote, that everybody designs who transforms an existing situation to a preferred one. The assumption that everybody is a designer, it is true we have a kind of innate human capacity to design. Mm-hmm. But in a world of ethics, governance, moral responsibility, is it really true that everybody should design in the public domain? Should there not be some kind of ethical charter for professional people to go by? So I think there is a kind of fluidity that's emerged, but I'm not convinced that design is everywhere and everybody is a designer. I still think there is a professional skill and a professional domain that still needs to be observed within itself.
In your opinion, how can culture become one of the foundations of social and economic innovation?
Well, I think this is where my interest in research comes, because I did a lot of work in the UK on assessing research in the arts and humanities, not just mm-hmm. design. And my view about this is that the arts and design have often pleaded a special case. That is, we are different from everybody else. And there is some truth in this. Mm-hmm. But unless you want to be part of the whole knowledge economy, which is the natural sciences, the physical sciences, the life sciences, unless you're willing to accept that, you become an isolated bubble. And I think one of the things that's difficult in the creative arts and design is the sense that we need our own terminology. We need to have our own particular circumstances in order for us to be seen in the way that we wish to be seen. And that has led, in my view, to a kind of isolation. Now, if you were to take the broader picture, I think there is a difference. I think the sciences, and particularly discovery science, is about using data from past events to understand natural phenomena. So we understand how the universe works, how the biology works, but that is using past data to understand things. Research in the creative arts is not about that. It's about innovation and creativity. It's about finding empty spaces to predict future possibilities. Now, it's not any better or worse than discovery science. Mm-hmm. And discovery science has innovation in it too, just as art and design research has some need for empirical bases. Mm-hmm. So these things overlap, but I'm afraid I think that the argument for culture being a separate enclave is not a good argument that we all need to get round.
Okay. Yeah, I agree 100%.
Yeah.
And I think that one of the things that we're striving to attain is the kind of understanding that this production of innovation can in itself be a scientific improvement, as one can build upon it, which is the quest for science, I think.
Yeah.
So, like, getting knowledge so that you can stack knowledge upon knowledge.
Yeah.
And so creativity may be as well something like that.
Well, if you were to accept that research in design is as much about analysis as it is about innovation, I think there is then a separate issue about how would you consider forms of innovation. And there are types of design that are about continuous refinement. Mm-hmm. You know, so if you have a beaker, a cup, or a vessel, you might want it to pour differently or pour better. You know, so there is an innovation that alters the flow of water or whatever it is, but it's still based on the form that existed before, so it's a continuous refinement. I think one of the problems in funding research is the world is facing so many big social challenges that this kind of continuous refinement is not helping us solve the big problems. The environmental problems, social and political instability, and so on. And there is an issue about trying to find what's called game-changing solutions, radical innovations. So these are not continuous refinements of an existing system or an existing form. There are different ways of looking at the problem that help you shift public behavior or mass behavior in order to deal with these issues. And I think that kind of innovation in design is a very, very special kind of contribution that we've not really done enough to develop, in my view.
Yes.
We leave it to the few mavericks, you know, and rather than finding a systematic way of doing it.
On Wednesday, I had a talk at Senses and Sensibility, and after my communication, someone came with a question about how did I feel like human-centered design would or is kind of outdated in nowadays, because we're now talking much more about user-centric design, and because it's quite difficult to put people into niches and to kind of attribute categories
I mean, one of the things I find tricky myself about research in the arts and in design is that if you were to compare it to another complex activity, say in the sciences, because the activity is complex, you need to, if you're dealing with each other, you need to have a language you're willing to share. And that language is quite precise. It might not be perfect, but at least you commonly understand the way in which you use the words you use. I think the trouble in the creative arts is we're always arguing over language, and we can never quite agree on a vocabulary that we will use. And it's quite loose many times. So to give you one example, you use the phrase user-centered or human-centered. Now, user-centered can mean many different things to different people. In one case, it can mean behavioral response. So you do some market research and you find out how people behave when they see something or they hear something. So the person, the user, is in the middle of that process, but they are an object of the process. Another definition of user-centered is that you understand the feelings and expectations of the person before you design something that helps them realize or to fulfill those expectations in a way that's meaningful to them. That's two completely different definitions of user-centered.
Yes, completely.
And I'm not sure we're often clear about what we mean by them.
But I think that that ambiguity is often used as also a stepping step for innovation. Like, you really don't know what you're going for until you're really there, and then you use it to kind of model. But the problem is that problem with common language. It's trying to understand what you're talking about.
Well, can I just pick you up on your use of the word ambiguity?
Sure.
To have the conversation and to take this through. You could have said uncertainty. And uncertainty and ambiguity are different things. I think uncertainty is important in research because you don't talk about solutions. You talk about questions.
Yes.
And the uncertainty is, where will my investigation of this take me? So I think uncertainty is very, very important. I think my difficulty with the word ambiguity is that if you, and I'm often asked this question, what is the difference between research and practice? in design. When is something research and when is it not research, particularly in the fine arts too? And I think there is a big difference here in terms of ambiguity between users and audiences.
Mm-hmm.
I think users of research are people who need to have the knowledge you have generated in order to help them solve a problem either in a community or in their lives or in the world at large. So you have to deliver that knowledge without ambiguity.
Okay.
There should be no ambiguity in the way that is driven to them.
But that's the problem with language.
Yeah, but then if you were to take audiences, which is a completely different ballgame, if you were to take somebody in the creative arts, they would not deliver the message unambiguously because they want to leave space for their audience to construct a reading or an understanding of the object that is their construction. So ambiguity is important there because it gives a space. But it's difficult if you then say that's research. And that's where the use of language and definitional mm-hmm. terms comes in my view, that we should transact a bit more and try and understand what we mean when we use these different terms.
Yes, yes, I understand it perfectly. Okay, this is about an article you wrote in 2011, which is called The State of Design. And you mention a new economy of meaning. The question is, how can this new economy of meaning affect the design and designers as professionals?
Right. I think, this is a question of language. I think I have a view that is not similar to many people who talk about meaning in design. And a lot of these people come from semiotic backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
Now, their view is that if you design an object in semiotic terms, it should have a reading. So if you look at a kettle or something else, apart from its utilitarian and functional value, you should read something in there that tells you something about yourself or about the domain in which it exists. So the reading is in the object.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe that's true. I think, and it comes back to what I said earlier about intrinsic human qualities, I think we have a head full of memories, a head full of stories, and a head full of narratives. We don't need people to give us new stories. What the object should do are be the visual signals that trigger back to life in your head, the things that you carry around with you every day of your life. So I think there is an issue for designers about understanding human mechanisms. How do people think and recollect things? How do they remember? How are these things triggered back into life? And to give you a severe example of it, designers only think about good things, you know, health and well-being. But design can be used for evil purposes. And if you look at the war in Bosnia and Herzegovina, the question is, how is it that people who lived together for many years as peaceful neighbours turned around and killed each other? That's because a dictator was able to use symbols of religious affiliation, symbols of national identity that caused people to be at odds with one another. And you can see it in the Holocaust and the fascist regimes. All of those regimes use images and symbols that bring back to life hidden memories in people. And if you can do that, if you do it, reasonableness disappears. People behave irrationally, they behave in ways they would not do in a civil society. So when I said earlier there is no ethical guidance for design, I think actually when you're dealing with that kind of use, power of design, you are dealing with people's consciousness, people's recollection of self-identity in themselves, which I think you cannot allow amateurs or people who are not trained or don't have ethical standards to just mess about within the media.
What I feel is that when you use design for evil, as you just said, it's done in a much more professional way than... So if you're aiming for positive, if you're aiming for good, sometimes it's just whimsical in a way. But if you're doing it for evil, I mean, people who did the propaganda for Nazis and... So that was really a really professionally done job.
People will not... We will not talk about the Holocaust and the fascist regime because it was so horrible. But if you put the horror to one side and you say, what was the mechanism that allowed this to happen? As a designer, I want to understand the mechanism because I don't want it to happen again.
Yes.
But you need to understand the mechanism to prevent
it.
And there's lots of fascism beginning to arise in the world again, underneath the surface, and we should be dealing with this. I think the answer to that is you have to remember that the Holocaust was a designed process. It was an intangible process, but it used physical symbols, it used physical objects, It had environments that the Nuremberg rallies were cathedrals, religious cathedrals of light. It used all of those design techniques to create this kind of design process. But it had profound effects. And those things are still at work in society. I think the problem actually happened after the war when we all were abhorred by this. I think prior to this, I think designers, although they probably wouldn't be called designers in the same way, were much more used to designing an object which had a meaning. So you weren't just designing the object. You were managing the meaning that went along with the object, and you knew you were doing it, and largely that was because there wasn't the evil consequences. I think what happened after the Second World War, particularly in Europe and America, is designers moved into styling for the capitalist market. And what they did was they removed their use of meaning and left other people, like the marketeers, the economists, and other people who were managing the consumer society, to exploit those human responses. And what designers became were designers of styled and well-designed objects. So in America, it was styling. But if you look in Europe at the Bauhaus, you know, Dieter Rams and Arne Jacobsen, who produced wonderful stuff that's iconic stuff in museums, you can't say that was designed from the standpoint of human behavior and human responses. Aesthetically, it was beautiful.
Yes.
But that sense of it being connected to human experience, particularly the Bauhaus, went to one side. And I think that's when design took a particular road. You know, and now design sees itself as an apolitical process. But actually, everything is political.
Of course.
And if you only see, you know, health and welfare and all the other things as part of what design does, which is good, and I would never undermine any of that, what you leave open is this other kind of underbelly, where now in the digital world, people are using these processes invisibly, you know, to manage, you know, very complex societies when we're all struggling to find forms of democracy. So I think there's a big issue for design, for me. And it's about accepting the political dimensions of design in a social context. Sorry, that was a long answer to your question.
Never mind. It's just... but so that means that design becomes like this social tool.
I think... Design was a tool of the merchant class at one point. Mm-hmm. You know, it was about feeding the capitalist system, which always has to grow. And, you know, and designing objects that were circulated was part of design. But at the end of the day, those objects were only about helping people find their self-identity, their sense of being in the world. They weren't just utilitarian. They weren't just about keeping warm, staying dry. You know, people would buy a coat because they felt it was not just protection, but it gave them a status or a particular kind of
identity
or affiliation. So all of these things have multiple levels. You know, so I think design, particularly in its intangible form, has a tremendous authority and power, particularly with masses of people, not just one or two, but when you're dealing with millions of people, design has a tremendous power to manage the way people think and behave. And you have to do it ethically and responsibly rather than the Holocaust, which was for purposes that none of us, you know, would subscribe to. But it is the same principle. It depends on the purpose, and the mechanisms are not that different, to be honest.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that's very, very tricky, you know, when you look at politics now, is that what the internet has done is it's destroyed the opportunity for one person to speak to millions. You know, so radio, television, film, books are all giving one person the authority to speak. To speak to the masses. So if you're a politician or you're somebody who wants to lead, you can deliver your message through those media. The problem with mobile smartphones and the internet is everybody can talk to everybody else. There is no one single message. There is this noise, you know, of all these people. So if you're a politician and you want to bring people together under your particular position, it's very hard to have a strategy that you can direct in the same way. So what's beginning to emerge is the strategy of moral indignation, which means that in order to bring things together, there always has to be another tribe who are barbarians, the other. You know, so it's maybe the Mexicans, it's maybe somebody else. But what you do is you create moral indignation about the others in order to bring together your tribe
but
under you.
But that was the same strategy as the Holocaust.
Yeah, it is, exactly, yeah.
And, yeah. And the thing is that now that in itself it is removing authority, because when you had one person that talked to the masses, at least you had a figure of authority.
Yeah.
Now you don't have that, so it's the and in a way that kind of takes morality out of it, because it's a non-entity. So,
I mean, the thing I find trickiest at the moment, personally, in terms of, you know, trying to, I mean, apart from being a designer, trying to think about your role in communities and in the world and where you should stand and what you should do, is I fundamentally believe in democratic freedom. I think everybody should have the opportunity to vote and to express their view. However, my experience is that the world is so complex and there are so many media channels that bombard you with information that you can trust or not trust. It is very, very difficult for any one person now to have a complete grasp of a complex problem and produce a meaningful vote that may represent, you know, the best way in which society should move. And what politicians have done, are doing, is because they can't make those decisions, they're handing it over through referenda to popular democracy. Trouble with that is, though, you end up with irrational solutions and unexpected outcomes. And my dilemma is, really, although I do believe in a single person, a single vote, an open democracy, the evidence is it's not working in this current context. But what's the alternative? As a designer, if you see that as a design problem,
yes.
What's the alternative?
Well, we can refer to the past, and we can go to the Greeks, whom invented democracy, and they didn't let anyone vote. There's this definition from, and I don't remember who, but I think she's a professor, an economics professor in the States, and she says that democracy is funded on information. So you need to be able to be truly informed, so you can exercise your vote in a conscient manner. And nowadays, the problem is that no one knows enough of a certain subject to really be... Because, as you said, lots of noise, lots of complex things going on.
But let me ask you a question about this, and this is about climate change. Mm-hmm. I began as an information designer because I felt socially, if you gave people uncorrupted information, they would be better placed to make informed decisions about their lives and about the world. Mm-hmm. I became disenchanted with that for two reasons. The first was, there is no such thing as uncorrupted information. Information is biased. Whoever does it, it will be biased in one way or another. You know, so there's nothing such as clean information. And the second is, even if you give it to people, would they use it to make an informed decision? And the evidence is actually not always. So if you take climate control, you could take an information design approach and you could say to people, do you realize in 5 years if you do this and you do this and you do this and you don't stop this, we will end up with a world that is completely different. We have done this. Has it changed human behavior? No. No. So if you really believe that the greater good is to control the custodianship of the environment in which we live, and that strategy is not working, you have to find another strategy. The difficulty with that is, if propaganda and rhetoric can persuade people's behavior to change, before it was for evil purposes, but if it can persuade them to change their behavior, would you feel comfortable using propaganda and rhetoric in order to save the environment? That's an ethical question.
It is.
And you see, my view is, yes, I would.
Yes,
because I think the environment's more important. But you need an ethical charter underneath it that controls, you know, the reasons you do these things and how you do them.
The do's and the don'ts.
Yeah.
Like the moral compass in which you set a line and you say, well, above this, okay, below this, no. That's.
But these are big issues for design, and design research. And they're not necessarily about the processes of design or the processes of research. The big question for me about research is, you should always ask yourself, what has changed because of my research? And if nothing has changed, you then have to say, well, why am I doing it? Is it to make my subject better, but it's not having any effect in the world? But if there is some effect, you then say, well, why does this change matter? And I think the great thing about design is it has an impact in the world. So the question always should be, what has changed because of my research? when I talk about research in this context, I'm only talking about academic research.
Of course.
I'm talking about research in universities and art schools conducted by academics.
Yes.
There is, you know, there is much other research that's done in industry and other places, but it has different mechanisms, same purposes, different mechanisms. I'm just talking about. One of the things I do believe is that it's important to assess research. And the reason, there's a number of reasons for that, is that many academics, I hate to say this, can be self-regulating. That is, you justify something because you did it.
Yes.
Instead of standing back and asking the hard questions. So I think independent assessment is important.
But that's one of the issues with fine arts. Many of the assessments that are done in fine arts have to do with self-regulation. It's a bit self-assessment there.
Well, let me because a lot of this comes down to language again, but let me just move tack and answer that question in the fine arts. I think one of the problems for all of us is we're not clear of our definition of research. And what we've inherited is a science model. It's the development of new knowledge or enhanced understanding. And that is true in discovery science. You know, as I said earlier, you use data from past events and you find out something new about the world. But if I'm honest, how many areas of art and design produce new knowledge, produce things that didn't exist in the world before or were known in the world? That actually really isn't where a lot of our work is. It may be in biotechnology and yarns and fibers, but generally no. There is another definition of design I think is important for research, which is it's testing the boundaries of existing knowledge in order to determine its limitations. You know, so you're not inventing new knowledge, but you're saying, this is how we see the world. Is it accurate? Is our view of society a defensible position? So all of the time you're testing current perceptions, because perceptions are only perceptions, but they govern societies. And I think a lot of fine artists are dealing with that kind of research. They're questioning existing orthodoxies to challenge them and to develop new forms. The trouble is, though, they don't articulate it that way because they still have this other thing called an audience, and they have to use ambiguity to leave the space for the audience to construct their reading or interpretation. So the kind of driving force gets lost in that process. And if artists are talking to artists, they will collude with each other in the process of ambiguity. And I think that's why... But if you then go back to design and user-based research, it's not about ambiguity. It's about delivering clean knowledge to people who need to use it, you know, out there. So there is a qualitative difference, but I still think it's about the language we use to describe these things. And one of the bits is we're not very good at defining what we mean by research. I mean, the other definition of research I would use is discovering lost knowledge. You know, so if you look at a lot of 3D visualization and computer imagery, civilizations before reading and writing, where there's no records, can be reconstructed now. And you can look at the way people lived in urban environments, the way in which they transacted, the flow of goods, and so on. So we're beginning to rediscover things that were before, you know, historical codes.
Data.
Yeah. You know, so discovery of lost knowledge, testing existing knowledge, they're all forms of research. But I think we have to be clear why we're doing it and not just adopt a science model, which is about new knowledge, developing new knowledge.
Yes. Well, here in Portugal, we do have that problem because even through law, the way the government came out with something that could be adaptable to design and fine arts was to figure out that any kind of artistic outlet is to be considered research outlet. So at least at par with research, which is in a way weird.
Yeah.
And then also because as people that tend to come and evaluate and they are a bit they're not comfortable with that read.
Yeah.
And so we get this kind of diminishing returns from considering that.
So I mean, a lot of people who work in universities and art schools have split lives. Mm-hmm. Half the life is in practice, in the studio, somewhere else, and half the life is in the university.
Yes.
And that's a complicated role because you're in two spaces, two intellectual and creative spaces. I'm only talking about life in the university.
You know.
And I think one of the problems in research is that if you were in the sciences, there would be an understanding of what a pool of knowledge is. You know, so you not only discovered something or you did something, but you'd leave a trace in the pool of knowledge. So somebody in 200 years' time could come back and say, well, they tried it, but it didn't work. The problem with a lot of creative arts and design work is if you have an artifact or a thing, because it's non-textual, it's very hard for it to speak of itself. You know, you can read it in different ways, but understanding what the research is just from the object is often very difficult for future generations. So there is no pool of knowledge being built. The other side to that is if you're an academic, half the job, as it is in other disciplines, should not only be the work that produces an understanding or knowledge, but it should be an account of that process that explains to people in the future how it was you arrived at this solution and why this solution was important or didn't work. And that's not a textual description of the thing itself. It's an additional piece of work which goes into the pool of knowledge, and a PhD student in 50 years can come and find it in a library somewhere and say, oh, I understand why they did it. Our problem is we're not willing to undertake the scholarship that is building the pool of knowledge. What we do is we produce the artifacts, and they are research often. I'm not arguing about that.
Yeah.
But they don't fulfill the whole role of academic research, the object by itself.
Because the object, if you go enough into the future, then will become ambiguous in interpretation.
Yeah, I mean, and I have to say that if you're in practice, there's nothing wrong with that. Mm-hmm. You know, so I'm not arguing a hierarchy or saying that one thing is more important than another, and I think practice is very important. And I think that deliberate ambiguity is important in terms of engaging audiences. I think, however, that an object can exist in both these spaces. Mm-hmm. It can exist in practice and be ambiguous, but it can also exist in the university and have a purpose. It doesn't have to be one or the other. But I think for it to exist in the university, there is an acceptance of what scholarship, not just research, but what is scholarship in the creative arts and design? What does it mean to be a scholar? Mm-hmm. And from my point of view, it means the willingness to leave a trace of your thoughts and your processes and your conclusions so that somebody in the future can access that and benefit from it, some other scholar. And if you're not willing to do that, it's practice. In my view, I have a very hard definition of this.
Okay. But don't you feel like, shouldn't the object be sufficiently self-explanatory so that if the knowledge is lost, it can still be read? I mean, take it, for example, the pyramids in Egypt.
Yeah.
In a sense, we're discovering that maybe it's not what we taught in school.
Yeah.
It's much prior than to what we thought, and that knowledge may have been lost. And as the object is not self-explanatory, then the knowledge itself it's lost, and it becomes just ambiguity and
or mystery.
Aesthetics mystery. Or mystery.
Yeah.
Yes.
So your position on this is it's better that things have an ambiguous life and there should not be a record, or...?
No, not really. No. I just think that we should, like, bridge the gap.
Yeah.
Understand that, so the pool of knowledge may also be fed with the object itself that is self-explanatory.
Yeah. Well, I think, I mean, again, there's no single answer to this. I think some objects explain themselves. You don't need anything else.
Yes.
You know, the way it functions, the way it operates, if it's utilitarian, has a utilitarian purpose, you don't need anything else sometimes. There are other times, however, where an object is intended to have a behavioral response in a group of people, and therefore it doesn't explain itself because the response it's looking for in order to manage a particular situation is dependent upon it not being read. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's legitimate.
Yes.
But if you're a researcher and you want to understand why the person did it and what they were hoping to achieve, you need something else that in the future allows you to understand why this mysterious object that didn't unravel itself was important in helping people understand or experience things in a particular way. So there's no one answer, but I think it is important to embrace the whole picture and use it when needed. I mean, the other thing I find tricky, you know, in working with academics, and it comes back to language, is, first of all, if you're doing research in the sciences academically, you're dealing with a well-embedded discipline. I mean, the ancient universities are 600 years old. You know, so people in the sciences and the humanities, the traditional humanities, have had a long time to develop scholarship. Mm-hmm. And during the period of the universities, art and design was not in the university. It was in the trades guilds. We were artisans. And it was only in the late 1800s, you know, when capitalism and the merchant class began to do the circulation of products, that's when art and design moved into institutionalized, out of the guilds and into institutions. So if you look at it, we're actually only about 200 years old. Not even that. And in terms of the government funding of research, it only started in Britain 30 years ago for art and design.
Yes.
And it's not happening yet in some other countries, in universities. Mm-hmm. So we are very, very young, you know, in terms of doing this. Mm-hmm. And I think there is some merit in accepting this, because what you then need to give is academics the time to grow and mature and another generation to come through, which is happening. But in the process, there needs to be some good definitional understanding. So, for example, I would say there is an enormous difference between scholarship and research. And there's a difference between research and impact. Scholarship is the ability to develop oneself and the subject through oneself. So you may read a book, you may, you know, read a canon of knowledge, and your scholarship of your discipline is helping you become a better informed person and to help you develop the discipline. And that is really, really important. But it is not research. Mm-hmm. Research is, as I said earlier, using that knowledge to test the boundaries of something in order to see its limitations or to do something else. And I think a lot of academics would see scholarship as research. And the trouble then is you don't have an outcome. And if you don't have an outcome, it doesn't have impact. And I would say the big issue for me is the difference between research and impact. And I'd say the trouble in universities, it can become a circular exercise where academics talk to other academics and design researchers talk to other design researchers and forget that design in the wild out there is for society at large. And this is why design is important. And I think there is something about impact, and the definition is, what has changed because of my research? Mm-hmm. Has anything changed? And you need to keep asking yourself these questions. But I think that vocabulary is still not well defined in universities and commonly shared, you know, to operate.
So you would agree that one of the lacking fields is to really take into our hands a definition, a language definition of what's design, what's research in design, so that we at least have a common ground language-wise that we can all refer to and understand what one's speaking when.
Yeah, I mean, the answer to that question is yes, but I have a caveat. I mean, there is a danger in the creative arts and design to feel once something is said, it's set in stone. And the reason we never agree is we don't want to set things in stone. And that's why to dispute things is part of the kind of... But politically, that's not very clever, because you then can't go out and speak to people in politics or social circles and persuade them through an argument. I think the other way to see it is that nothing is fixed in stone, and nothing is perfect. All you have is what you know at any one moment in time, and you're prepared to agree with your colleagues to do. So you do the best you can at that moment. And as you gain experience, it's an iterative process. It changes and it grows and it modifies itself. So you end up with increasing sophistication and often simplification. It gets less complex as you get better of the language you choose to transact. But you have to start the process by saying, we're willing to accept the best we can do and we're willing to refine it, rather than to continuously dispute it.
But is that easy? I mean, in the one hand, you have creativity, and normally this, as a discipline, is something a bit self-centric.
Right.
And on the other hand, your search is for compromise. So if you have something that's self-centered and it needs to compromise with a whole field of people that are also self-centered, it's going to be tough, and that's...
Well, let me give you a challenge with one concrete example. You know the OECD, the kind of... It produces something called the Frascati Manual of Research, yeah?
Yes.
And it's used by governments and it's used by people in many countries across Europe. If you go through that, there is no definite... Well, there's two paragraphs on artistic research now.
Yes.
But otherwise, there was nothing before. Mm-hmm. And those two paragraphs are quite dismissive. Now, the challenge is there needs to be something in there about research in the creative arts and design. And it may not be perfect, but can we all agree something that we would be willing to put into the Frascati manual and say, these are our definitional terms, and this is how we see it. Because if the answer to that is no, we can never produce something. There's still this big blank space in the Frascati manual and in the research landscape of Europe.
But don't you feel that that's, again, something of a lack of authority? Because we, in the arts and design world, we don't really defer to anyone. And so this metric of knowledge is a bit dismissive in a way. And so I think that we struggle to come to a definition because we don't feel that no one can tell us really what's their definition or impose a certain kind of definition. It's tricky.
But you see, I think there's a design issue here, and it's the difference between self and society.
I know.
And it's not one or the other. I think it is very important that people are able to define the world in the way they wish to define it. However, we have to live together as a community, and that means making concessions, you know, and coming to agreements with all these different people that we live alongside. And it's not one thing or the other, and it is a design issue. How do you build the bridge between self and society so that you respect individual freedom and individual views, but the community at large has a view of what matters to that community and the pillars it's willing to stand by? And I think that's quite a complicated exercise, but you have to see the whole thing in the round and approach it as a designer and say, how do we get there? And of course, one of the answers is to set up professional associations, to have meetings with professional associations to make sure they discuss this, to make sure there are proposals that can be answered. And through discussion and an argument, you begin to build a disputable proposition that everybody will at some point make concessions about and agree is the best they can come up with. You know, so you have to design that ecosystem, that culture that gets people to that position. I think what you're defining is people who take for granted the society in which we live, and everybody just wants to be an autonomous individual.
Yes.
With their view.
Yes, because I feel like that in the design community and the arts community, what you said about accountability and governance is seen like some bad thing, you know?
Oh, well, you see, I have very strong feelings about governance, which I think is a design issue. Because if you're in an organization, you have a board of governors, you know, your board of trustees, and those are the people who govern your life in the university. And basically, they are there to say, these are the boundaries of what we consider to be reasonable. And if you step outside the boundary, we will take action against you or we will do something. So governance is about the rules by which the community agrees civilly to respect and to work with each other. However, those rules should not be complicated. They should be thin. They shouldn't be thick.
Yeah.
They should be thin. But nevertheless, it is governance. And the art of governance is to find that thin skin where everybody can have a sense of self and a self of individual liberty. Mm-hmm. But there nevertheless is a ring that says, we believe in this particular community, we will not sell meat in the canteen. You know, we will not allow tobacco smoking inside buildings. You know, those are rules of governance.
Yeah.
But I think governance is quite important. I think designers don't pay enough attention to issues of governance in organizations and in society and where the edges are.
So that may be the problem.
Yeah.
Why we don't have anything in the Frascati.
Yeah, I mean, if you read the Frascati manual, I mean, it's only two paragraphs, and I was shocked when I read it. I was shocked by the fact that our own community had not provided or produced something that was more sophisticated or more politically more forceful in building the position for the work that we do. You know, so for me, I mean, I always like tangible objectives in all of this theoretical and critical debate. One objective would be is, how do you get something into the Frascati manual? And how do you get the community to agree to it? So we have something at least to work to and to talk to politicians about.
Yes, I think that would be a goal.
A goal and an achievement,
yes.
And it can be done, yeah.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
And it might take 5 years, you know, to get a kind of consensus.
Sure, sure. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Good.
You enjoyed it. We enjoyed it.
We did. We did. I did.
Good.
If
you like what you heard today, please subscribe to our podcast on the main platform. For more information about the Unreleased podcast, go to unreleased.unitcom-yad.pt. There you can find all the episodes and more information about our guests. Unreleased podcast is the result of the work of the students of Design Cultures and Practices course from the PhD in Design program of Yad Universidade Europeia. It's produced and edited by Unitcom.